left the ridge. Now, 8 days later, a thick scurf of dark stubble did give him a fiercely ursine look. It occurred to me that beyond convenience, a heavy beard undoubtedly kept the face warm on nights like this. I tucked my own bare and vulnerable chin down into the sheltering folds of my shawl. Returning from the horses in time to hear this, Jamie laughed too, but it ended in a spasm of coughing. Evan waited till it ended.
"How say you, McDo? Head or tails?"
Jamie wiped his mouth on his sleeve and smiled. Hairy as the rest, he looked a proper Viking, with the fire glinting red, gold and silver from his sprouting beard and loosened hair.
"Nay bother, lads," he said. "I'll sleep warm enough, no matter how I'm laid."
He tilted his head in my direction, and there was a general rumble of laughter, with a spattering of mildly crude remarks in Scots and Gaelic from the ridgemen. One or two of the new recruits eyed me with a brief instinctive speculation, quickly abandoned after a glance at Jamie's height, breadth, and air of genial ferocity. I met one man's eyes and smiled. He looked startled, but then smiled back, ducking his head in shyness. How the hell did Jamie do that? One brief crude joke, and he'd laid public claim to me, removed me from any threat of unwanted advances, and reasserted his position as leader. "Just like a bloody baboon troop," I muttered under my breath, "and I'm sleeping with the head baboon."
"Baboons are the monkeys with no tails?"
Jamie asked, turning back to me from an exchange with Ewald about the horses. "You know quite well they are." I caught his eye, and his mouth curled up on one side. I knew what he was thinking, and he knew I did. The smile widened. Louis of France kept a private zoo at Versailles, among the inhabitants of which were a small troop of mandrill baboons. One of the most popular court activities on spring afternoons was to visit the baboon quarters, there to admire both the sexual prowess of the male and his splendidly multicoloured bottom. One Monsieur de Ruvel had offered, in my hearing, to have his posterior similarly tattooed if it would result in such a favourable reception by the ladies of the court. He had, however, been firmly informed by Madame de la Tourelle that his physique was in every way inferior to that of the mandrill, and colouring it was unlikely to improve matters. The firelight made it difficult to tell, but I was reasonably sure that Jamie's own rich colour owed as much to suppressed amusement as to heat.
"Speaking of tails," he murmured in my ear, "have you got those infernal breeks on?"
"Yes."
"Take them off."
"What? Here?" I gave him a wide-eyed look of mock innocence. "You want me to freeze my arse off?" His eyes narrowed slightly with a blue cat gleam in the depths.
"Oh, I wouldna freeze," he said softly. "I'll warrant you that."
He moved behind me, and the fierce shimmer of the blaze on my flesh was replaced by the cool solidness of his body. No less fierce, though, as I discovered when he'd put his arms round my waist and drew me back against him. "Oh, you found it," I said. "How nice."
"Found what? Had you lost something?"
Roger paused, coming from the horses with a lumpy roll of blankets under one arm, his bothran under the other.
"Oh, just a pair of old breeks," Jamie said blandly.
Under cover of my shawl, one hand slid inside the waistband of my skirt.
"Do you mean to give us a song, then?"
"If anyone likes, sure," Roger smiled, the firelight ruddy on his features.
"Actually, I'm meaning to learn one. Evans promised to sing me a silky song his granny knew."
Jamie laughed.
"Oh, I ken that one, I think."
One of Roger's eyebrows shot up, and I twisted slightly round to look up at Jamie in surprise.
"Well, I couldna sing it," he said mildly, seeing our amazement. "I ken the words, though. Evan sang it often and again in the prison at Ardsmuir. It's a bit bawdy," he added,
with that faintly prim tone that Highlanders often adopt just before telling you something truly shocking. Roger recognised it and laughed.
"I'll maybe write it down then, for the benefit of future generations.
Jamie's fingers had been working skillfully away, and at this point the breeks, which were his, and thus about 6 sizes too large for me, came loose and dropped silently to the ground. A cold draught whooshed up under my skirt and struck my newly bared nether portions. I drew in my breath with a faint gasp.
Cold, isn't it?
Roger hunched his shoulders, smiling as he shivered exaggeratedly in sympathy.
Yes, indeed, I said.
Freeze the balls of a brass monkey, wouldn't it? Jamie and Roger burst into simultaneous coughing fits. Sentry in place and horses bedded down, we retired to our own resting place, a discreet distance from the circle by the fire. I had dug the largest rocks and twigs out of the leaf mould, cut spruce branches, and spread our blankets over them by the time Jamie finished his last round of the camp. The warmth of food and fire had faded, but I didn't begin to shiver in earnest until he touched me. I would have moved at once to get under the blankets, but Jamie still held me. His original intent appeared intact, to say the least, but his attention was momentarily distracted. His arms were still clasped round me, but he was standing quite still, head up as though listening, looking into the murk of the wood. It was full dark. No more showed of the trees than the glow of fire reflected from the few trunks that stood nearest the camp. The last shadow of twilight had faded, and everything beyond was a depthless black. "What is it?" I drew back a little, pressing instinctively against him, and his arms tightened round me.
"I dinna ken, but I do feel something, Sassenach."
He moved a little, lifting his head in restless query like a wolf scenting the wind. But no message reached us, save a distant rattling of leafless branches.
"If it's no rhinoceroses, it's something,"
he said softly, and a whisper of unease raised the hairs on the back of my neck.
"A moment, lass."
He left me, the wind blowing suddenly cold about me with the loss of his presence, and went to speak quietly with a couple of the men. And what might he feel out there in the dark? I had the greatest respect for Jamie's sense of danger. He had lived too long as hunter and as hunted not to sense the edgy awareness that lay between the two, invisible or not. He returned a moment later and squatted beside me as I burrowed shivering into the blankets.
"That's all right," he said. "I've said we'll have 2 guards tonight, and each man to keep his piece loaded and to hand. But I think it's all right."
He looked beyond me into the wood, but his face now was merely thoughtful.
"It's all right," he repeated again, more certainly.
"Is it gone?" He turned his head, his lips curling slightly. His mouth looked soft, tender and vulnerable amid the stiff, ruddy wires of his starting beard.
"I dinna ken if it was ever there, Sassenach," he said. "I thought I felt eyes upon me. But it could have been a passing wolf, an owl, or nae more than a restless spirit roaming in the wood. But aye, it's gone now."
He smiled at me. I saw the flicker of the light that rimmed his head and shoulders as he turned, silhouetted by the fire. Beyond, the sound of Roger's voice drifted to me above the crackle of the fire as he learned the melody of the Silky Song, following Evan's voice, hoarse but confident. Jamie slid into the blankets beside me, and I turned to him, cold hands fumbling to return the favour he had done me earlier. We shivered convulsively, urgent for each other's warmth. I found him, and he turned me, ruffling up the layers of fabric between us, so that he lay behind me, his arms secure around me, the small secret patches of our nakedness joined in warmth beneath the blankets. I lay facing the darkness of the wood, watching the firelight dance among the trees, as Jamie moved behind me. Behind, between, within, warm and big. And so slowly, as scarcely to rustle the branches beneath us. Roger's voice rose strong and sweet above the murmur of the men, and the shivering slowly stopped.
I woke much later beneath a blue-black sky, dry-mouthed, the rasping sigh of Jamie's breath in my ear. I'd been dreaming, one of those pointless dreams of uneasy repetition that fades at once with the waking, but leaves a nasty taste in mouth and mind. Needing both water and relief of my bladder, I squirmed carefully out from under Jamie's arm and slid out from between the blankets. He stirred and groaned slightly, snuffling in his sleep, but didn't wake. I paused to lay a hand lightly on his forehead. Cool, no fever. Perhaps he was right then. Just a bad cold. I stood up, reluctant to leave the warm sanctuary of our nest, but knowing I couldn't wait until morning. The songs were stilled. The fire smaller now, but still burning, kept up by the sentry on duty. It was Murdo Lindsay. I could see the white fur of his possum skin cap perched atop what looked like a huddled pile of clothing and blankets. The anonymous Glaswegian crouched on the other side of the clearing, musket on his knees. He nodded to me, face shadowed by the brim of his slouch hat. The white cap turned in my direction too at the sound of my step. I sketched a wave, and Murdo nodded toward me, then turned back toward the wood. The men lay in a shrouded circle, buried in their blankets. I felt a sudden qualm as I walked between them. With the spell of night and dream still on me, I shivered at sight of the silent forms lying so still, side by side. Just so had they laid the bodies at Amiens, at Preston. Still and shrouded, side by side, faces covered and anonymous. War seldom looks on the faces of its dead. And why should I wake from love's embrace, thinking of war and the sleeping ranks of dead men? I wondered, stepping lightly past the shrouded line of bodies. Well, that was simple enough, given our errand. We were headed for battle. If not now, then soon enough. One blanket-wrapped form grunted, coughed, and turned over, face invisible, indistinguishable from the others. The movement startled me, but then one big foot thrust free of the blanket, revealing Evan Lindsay's twine-wrapped shoe. I felt the anxious burden of imagination ease with this evidence of life, of individuality. It's the anonymity of war that makes killing possible. When the nameless dead are named again on tombstone and on cenotaph, then they regain the identity they lost as soldiers and take their place in grief and memory, the ghosts of sons and lovers. Perhaps this journey would end in peace. The conflict that was coming, though, the world would hear of that. And I stepped past the last of the sleeping men as though walking through an evil dream not fully waked from. I picked up a canteen from the ground near the saddlebags and drank deep. The water was piercingly cold, and my sombre thoughts began to dissipate, washed away by the sweet, clean taste of it. I paused, gasping from the coldness, and wiped my mouth. Best take some back to Jamie. If he wasn't wakened by my absence, he would be by my return, and I knew his mouth would be dry as well, since he was completely unable to breathe through his nose at the moment. I slung the strap of the canteen over my shoulder and stepped into the shelter of the wood. It was cold under the trees, but the air was still and crystal clear. The shadows that had seemed sinister, viewed from the fireside, were oddly reassuring, seen from the shelter of the wood. Turned away from the fire's glow and crackle, my eyes and ears began to adapt to the dark. I heard the rustle of something small in the dried grass nearby, and the unexpected, distant hooting of an owl. Finished, I stood still for a few minutes, enjoying the momentary solitude. It was very cold, but very peaceful. Jamie had been right, I thought. Whatever might or might not have been here earlier, the wood held nothing inimical now. As though my thought of him had summoned him, I heard a cautious footfall and the slow wheezing rasp of his breath. He coughed, a muffled, strangled noise that I didn't like at all. "Here I am," I said softly. "How's the chest?"
The cough choked off in a sudden wheeze of panic, and there was a crunch and flurry among the leaves. I saw Murdo start up by the fire, musket in hand, and then a dark shape darted past me. "Hoy!" I said, startled rather than frightened. The shape stumbled, and by reflex I swung the canteen off my shoulder and whirled it by the strap. It struck the figure in the back with a hollow thunk, and whoever it was, certainly not Jamie, fell to his knees, coughing. There followed a short period of chaos, with men exploding out of their blankets like startled jack-in-the-boxes, incoherent shouting and general mayhem. The Glaswegian leapt over several struggling bodies and charged into the wood, musket over his head, bellowing. Barreling into the darkness, he charged the first shape he saw, which happened to be me. I went flying headlong into the wet leaves, where I ended inelegantly sprawled and windless, the Glaswegian kneeling on my stomach. I must have given a sufficiently feminine grunt as I fell, for he paused, narrowly checking himself as he was about to club me in the head. "Eh?" He put down his free hand and felt cautiously. Feeling what was unmistakably a breast, he jerked back as though burned and slowly edged off me. he said. "Woof," I replied, as cordially as possible. The stars were spinning overhead, shining brightly through the leafless branches. The Glaswegian disappeared with a small Scottish noise of embarrassment. There was a lot of shouting and crashing off to my left, but I hadn't attention for anything at the moment, bar getting my wind back. By the time I made it back onto my feet, the intruder had been captured and dragged into the light of the fire. Had he not been coughing when I hit him, he likely would have gotten away. As it was, though, he was hacking and wheezing so badly that he could barely stand upright, and his face was dark with the effort to snatch a breath in passing. The veins on his forehead stood out like worms, and he made an eerie whistling noise as he breathed, or tried to.
"What the hell are you doing here?"
Jamie demanded hoarsely, then paused to cough in sympathy. This was a purely rhetorical question, since the boy plainly couldn't talk. It was Josiah Beardsley, my potential tonsillectomy patient. And whatever he'd been doing since the gathering, it hadn't improved his health to any marked extent. I hurried to the fire where the coffee pot sat in the embers. I seized it in a fold of my shawl and shook it. Good. There was some left, and since it had been brewing since supper, it would be as strong as Hades. "Sit him down, loosen his clothes, bring me cold water." I shoved my way into the circle of men around the captive, forcing them aside with the hot coffee pot. Within a moment or two, I had a mug of strong coffee at his lips, black and tarry, diluted with no more than a splash of cold water to keep it from burning his mouth. "Breathe out slowly to the count of four. Breathe in to the count of two. Breathe out and take a drink," I said. The whites of his eyes showed all round the iris, and spittle had collected at the corners of his mouth. I put a firm hand on his shoulder, though, urging him to breathe, to count, to breathe, and the desperate straining eased a little. One sip, one breath, one sip, one breath, and by the time the coffee was all inside him, his face had faded from its alarming crimson hue to something more approximating fish belly, with a couple of faint reddish marks where the men had hit him. The air still whistled in his lungs, but he was breathing, which was a substantial improvement. The men stood about, murmuring and watching with interest. But it was cold, it was late, and as the excitement of the capture faded, they began to droop and yawn. It was, after all, only a lad, and a scrawny, ill-favoured one at that. They departed willingly enough to their blankets when Jamie dispatched them, leaving Jamie, Roger, and me to attend to our unexpected guest. I had him swaddled in spare blankets larded with camphorated bear grease and provided with another cup of coffee in his hands before I would let Jamie question him. The boy seemed deeply embarrassed at my attentions, shoulders hunched and eyes on the ground, but I didn't know whether he was simply unused to being fussed over or whether it was the looming presence of Jamie, arms crossed, that discomforted him. He was small for 14, and thin to the point of emaciation. I could have counted his ribs when I opened his shirt to listen to his heart. No beauty otherwise. His black hair had been chopped short and stood on his head in matted spikes, thick with dirt, grease, and sweat, and his general aspect was that of a flea-ridden monkey, eyes large and black, in a face pinched with worry and suspicion. At last, having done all I could, I was satisfied with the look of him. At my nod, Jamie lowered himself to the ground beside the boy.
"So, Mr. Beardsley," he said pleasantly, "have you come to join our troop of militia, then?"
No. Josiah rolled the wooden cup between his hands, not looking up. My business chanced to take me this way, that's all." He spoke so hoarsely that I winced in sympathy, imagining the soreness of his inflamed throat.
"I see."
Jamie's voice was low and friendly.
"So you saw our fire by chance, and thought to come and seek shelter and a meal?"
"I did,
aye."
He swallowed with evident difficulty.
"Mm-hmm. But you came earlier, no? You were in the wood just after sundown. Why wait till past moonrise to make yourself known?"
"I didn't. I wasn't."
"Oh, indeed you were."
Jamie's voice was still friendly, but firm. He put out a hand and grasped Josiah's shirt front, forcing the boy to look at him.
"Look here, man. There's a bargain between us. You're my tenant. It's agreed. That means you've a right to my protection. It means also that I've a right to hear the truth."
Josiah looked back, and while there was fear and wariness in the look, there was also a sense of self-possession that seemed far older than 14. He made no effort to look away, and there was a look of deep calculation in the clever black eyes. This child, if one could regard him as a child, plainly Jamie didn't, was used to relying on himself alone. "I said to you, sir, that I would come to your place by the new year, and so I mean to. What I do in the meantime is my own affair." Jamie's brows shot up, but he nodded slowly and released his grip.
"True enough. You'll admit, though, that one might be curious."
The boy opened his mouth as though to speak, but changed his mind and buried his nose instead in his cup of coffee. Jamie tried again.
"May we offer you help in your business? Will you travel a ways with us, at least?"
Josiah shook his head.
"No, I'm obliged to you, sir, but the business is best managed by myself alone."
Roger had been sitting a little way behind Jamie, watching silently. He leaned forward now, green eyes intent on the boy.
"This business of yours," he said, "is not by any means connected with that mark on your thumb."
The cup hit the ground and coffee splashed up, spattering my face and bodies. The boy was out of his blankets and halfway across the clearing before I could blink my eyes to see what was happening. And by then, Jamie was up and after him. The boy had circled the fire. Jamie leapt over it. They disappeared into the wood like fox and hound, leaving Roger and myself gaping after them. For the second time that night, men erupted from their bedrolls, grabbing for their guns. I began to think the governor would be pleased with his militia. They were certainly ready to spring into action at a moment's notice.
"What in hell?"
I said to Roger, wiping coffee from my eyebrows.
"Maybe I shouldn't have mentioned it so suddenly," he said. What a mess, then!"
bellowed Murdo Lindsay, glaring round as he swept his musket barrel past the shadowed trees.
"Are we attacked? Where's the bastards?"
Kenny popped up on hands and knees beside me, peering out from under the band of his knitted cap like a toad beneath a watering pot.
"Nobody!"
"Nothing's happened. I mean, it's really quite all right." My efforts to calm and explain went largely unnoticed in the racket. Roger, however, being much larger and much louder, succeeded at last in quelling the disturbance and explaining matters, so far as they could be explained. What did a lad more or less matter? With considerable grumbling, the men settled down once more, leaving Roger and me staring at each other over the coffee pot.
"What was it, then?" I asked, a little testily. "The mark? I'm pretty sure it was the letter T. I saw it when you made him take the coffee, and he wrapped his hand round the cup."
My stomach tightened. I knew what that meant. I'd seen it before.
"Thief," Roger said, eyes on my face. "He's been branded."
"Yes," I said unhappily. "Oh, dear."
"Would the folk on the ridge not accept him if they knew?" Roger asked.
"I doubt most of them would be much bothered," I said.
"It's not that. It's that he ran when you mentioned it.
He isn't just a convicted thief. I'm afraid he may be a fugitive. And Jamie called him at the gathering."
"Ah." Roger scratched absently at his whiskers.
"Fealty.
Jamie will feel obliged to him in some way, then."
"Something like that." Roger was a Scot, and technically at least, a Highlander, but he had been born long after the death of the clans, and neither history nor heritage could ever have taught him the strength of the ancient bonds between laird and tenant, between chief and clansman. Most likely Josiah himself had no idea of the importance of the fealty, of what had been promised and accepted on both sides. Jamie had.
"Do you think Jamie will catch him?" Roger asked.
"I expect he already has. He can't be tracking the boy in the dark, and if he'd lost him, he would have come back already."
"There were other possibilities. That Jamie had fallen over a precipice in the dark, tripped on a stone and broken his leg, or met with a catamount or a bear, for instance. But I preferred not to dwell on those."
I stood up, stretched my cramped limbs, and looked into the woods where Jamie and his prey had disappeared. Josiah might be a good woodsman and hunter. Jamie had been one much longer. Josiah was small, quick, and impelled by fear. Jamie had a considerable advantage in size, strength, and sheer bloody-mindedness. Roger stood up beside me. His lean face was slightly troubled as he peered into the encircling trees.
"It's taking a long time. If he's caught the lad, what's he doing with him?"
"Extracting the truth from him, I imagine," I said. I bit my lip at the thought. "Jamie doesn't like being lied to."
Roger looked down at me, mildly startled. "How?"
I shrugged. "However he can. I'd seen him do it by reason, by guile, with charm, with threats, and, on occasion, by means of brute force. I hoped he hadn't had to use force, though more for his sake than Josiah's."
"I see," Roger said quietly. "Well, then."
The coffee pot was empty. I bundled my cloak round me and went down to the stream to rinse and fill it, hung it to brew once more above the fire, and sat down to wait.
"You should go to sleep," I said to Roger after a few minutes.
He merely smiled at me, wiped his nose, and hunched deeper into his cloak.
"So should you," he said.
There was no wind, but it was very late, and the cold had settled well into the hollow, lying damp and heavy on the ground. The men's blankets had grown limp with condensation, and I could feel the dense chill of the ground seeping through the folds of my skirt. I thought about retrieving my breeches, but couldn't muster the energy to search for them. The excitement of Josiah's appearance and escape had faded, and the lethargy of cold and fatigue was setting in. Roger poked up the fire a bit and added a few small chunks of wood. I tucked another fold of skirt beneath my thighs and pulled cloak and shawl close around me, burying my hands in the folds of fabric. The coffee pot hung steaming, the hiss of occasional droplets falling into the fire, punctuating the phlegm-filled snores of the sleeping men. I wasn't seeing the blanket-rolled shapes, though, or hearing the sough of dark pines.
I heard the crackle of dried leaves in a Scottish oak wood in the hills above Carriarrick. We had camped there 2 days before Prestonpans, with 30 men from Lallybroch, on our way to join Charles Stuart's army. And a young boy had come suddenly out of the dark. A knife had glinted in the light of a fire. A different place, a different time. I shook myself, trying to dispel the sudden memories. A thin, white face, and a boy's eyes huge with shock and pain. The blade of a dirk darkening and glowing in the embers of the fire. The smell of gunpowder, sweat, and burning flesh.
"I mean to shoot you," he had told John Grey. "Head or heart?"
By threat, by guile, by brute force. That was then. This was now, I told myself. But Jamie would do what he thought he must. Roger sat quietly, watching the dancing flames and the wood beyond. His eyes were hooded, and I wondered what he was thinking.
"Do you worry for him?"
he asked softly, not looking at me. "What now? Or ever?" I smiled, though without much humour. If I did, I'd never rest. He turned his head toward me, and a faint smile touched his lips.
"You're resting now, are you?"
I smiled again, a real one, in spite of myself. "I'm not pacing to and fro," I answered, "nor yet wringing my hands." One dark eyebrow flicked up.
"Might help keep 'em warm."
One of the men stirred, muttering in his wrappings, and we ceased talking for a moment. The coffee pot was boiling. I could hear the soft rumble of the liquid inside. Whatever could be keeping him? He couldn't be taking all this time to question Josiah Beardsley. He would either have gotten what answers he required in short order, or he would have let the boy go. No matter what the boy had stolen, it was no concern of Jamie's, save for the promise of the fealty. The flames were mildly hypnotic. I could look into the wavering glow and see in memory the great fire of the gathering, the figures dark around it, and the sounds of distant fiddles.
"Should I go to look for him?"
Roger asked suddenly, low-voiced. I jerked, startled out of sleepy hypnosis. I rubbed a hand over my face and shook my head to clear it. "No. It's dangerous to go into strange woods in the dark, and you couldn't find him anyway. If he isn't back by the morning, that will be time enough." As the moments wore slowly on, I began to think that the dawn might come before Jamie did. I was worried for Jamie, but there was, in fact, nothing that could be done before the morning. Disquieting thoughts tried to push their way in. Did Josiah have a knife? Surely he did. But even if the boy was desperate enough to use it, could he possibly take Jamie by surprise? I pushed aside these anxious speculations, trying to occupy my mind instead with counting coughs from the men around the fire. Number 8 was Roger, a deep, loose cough that shook his shoulders. Was he worried for Bree and Jemmy, I wondered. Or did he wonder whether Bree worried about him? I could have told him that, but it wouldn't have helped him to know. Men fighting, or preparing to fight, needed the idea of home as a place of utter safety. The conviction that all was well there kept them in good heart and on their feet, marching, enduring. Other things would make them fight. But fighting is such a small part of warfare.
"A damned important part, Sassenach,"
said Jamie's voice in the back of my head. I began at last to nod off, waking repeatedly as my head jerked sharply on my neck. The last time, it was the feel of hands on my shoulders that wakened me, but only briefly. Roger eased me to the ground, wadding half my shawl beneath my head for a pillow, tucking the rest of it snug about my shoulders. I caught a brief glimpse of him in silhouette against the fire, black and bear-like in his cloak, and then I knew no more. I don't know how long I slept. I woke quite suddenly at the sound of an explosive sneeze nearby.
Jamie was sitting a few feet away, holding Josiah Beardsley's wrist in one hand, his dirk in the other. He paused long enough to sneeze twice more, wiped his nose impatiently on his sleeve, then thrust the dirk into the embers of the fire. I caught the stink of hot metal and raised myself abruptly on one elbow. Before I could say or do anything, something twitched and moved against me. I looked down in astonishment, then up, then down again, convinced in my muddled state that I was still dreaming. A young boy lay under my cloak, curled against my body, sound asleep. I saw black hair and a scrawny frame, a pallid skin smeared with grime and grazed with scratches. Then there was a sudden loud hiss from the fire, and I jerked my gaze back to see Jamie press Josiah's thumb against the searing metal of his blackened dirk. Jamie glimpsed my convulsive movement from the corner of his eye and scowled in my direction, lips pursed in a silent adjuration to stillness. Josiah's face was contorted, lips drawn back from his teeth in agony, but he made no noise. On the far side of the fire, Kenny Lindsay sat watching, silent as a rock. Still convinced that I was dreaming, or hoping that I was, I put a hand on the boy curled against me. He moved again, and the feel of solid flesh under my fingers woke me completely. My hand closed on his shoulder, and his eyes sprang open, wide with alarm. He jerked away, scrambling awkwardly to get to his feet. Then he saw his brother, for plainly Josiah was his brother, and stopped abruptly, glancing wildly around the clearing at the scattered men, at Jamie, Roger, and myself. Ignoring what must have been the frightful pain of a burned hand, Josiah rose from his seat and stepped quick and soft to his brother's side, taking him by the arm. I got to my feet, moving slowly so as not to frighten them. They watched me, identical looks of wariness on the thin white faces. Identical? Yes, just the same pinched faces, though the other boy's hair was worn long. He was dressed in nothing but a ragged shirt, and he was barefoot. I saw Josiah squeeze his brother's arm in reassurance, and began to suspect just what it was he had stolen. I summoned a smile for the two of them, then stretched out my hand to Josiah. "Let me see your hand," I whispered. He hesitated a moment, then gave me his right hand. It was a nice, neat job, so neat that it made me slightly faint for a moment. The ball of the thumb had been sliced cleanly off, the open wound cauterized with searing metal. A red-black, crusted oval had replaced the incriminating brand. There was a soft movement behind me. Roger had fetched my medicine box and set it down by my feet. There wasn't a great deal to do for the injury, save apply a little gentian ointment and bandage the thumb with a clean, dry cloth. I was conscious of Jamie as I worked. He had sheathed his dirk and risen quietly to go and rummage among the packs and saddlebags. By the time I had finished my brief job, he was back, with a small bundle of food wrapped in a kerchief and a spare blanket tied in a roll. Over his arm were my discarded breeches. He handed these to the new boy, gave the food and blanket to Josiah, then clapped a hand on the boy's shoulder and squeezed hard. He touched the other boy gently, turning him toward the wood with a hand on his back. Then he jerked his head toward the trees, and Josiah nodded. He touched his forehead to me, the bandage glinting white on his thumb, and whispered, "Thank you, ma'am." The two boys disappeared silently into the forest, the twins' bare feet winking pale below the flapping hem of the breeks as he followed his brother. Jamie nodded to Kenny, then sat down again by the fire, shoulders slumping in sudden exhaustion. I poured him coffee, and he took it, his mouth twitching in an attempted smile of acknowledgement that dissipated in a fit of heavy coughing. I reached for the cup before it could spill, and caught Roger's eye over Jamie's shoulder. He nodded toward the east and laid a finger across his lips, then shrugged with a grimace of resignation. He wanted as much as I did to know what had just happened and why.
He was right, though. The night was fading. Dawn would be here soon, and the men, all accustomed to wake at first light, would be floating toward the surface of consciousness. Jamie had stopped coughing, but was making horrible gurgling noises in an attempt to clear his throat. He sounded rather like a pig drowning in mud. "Here," I whispered, giving him back the cup. "Drink it and lie down. You should sleep a little." He shook his head and lifted the cup to his lips. He swallowed, grimacing at the bitterness. "Not worth it," he croaked. He nodded toward the east, where the tufted pines were now inked black on a greying sky. "And besides, I've got to think what the hell to do now."
This ends Disc 13. The Fiery Cross, Disc 14.
Chapter 27. Death comes calling. I could scarcely contain my impatience until the men had roused and eaten, broken camp, in an irritatingly leisurely fashion, and mounted. At last, though, I found myself once more on horseback, riding through a morning so crisp and cold I thought the air might shatter as I breathed it. "Right," I said without preamble, as my mount nosed her way up next to Jamie's. "Talk." He glanced back at me and smiled. His face was creased with tiredness, but the brisk air and a lot of very strong coffee had revived him. Despite the troubled night, I felt quick and lively myself, blood coursing near the surface of my skin and blooming in my cheeks.
"You didn't mean to wait for wee Roger?"
"I'll tell him later, or you can." There was no way of riding three abreast. It was only owing to a washout that had left a fan of gravel down the mountainside that we were able to pick our way side by side for the moment, out of hearing of the others. I nudged my mount closer to Jamie's, my knees wreathed in steam from the horse's nostrils. Jamie rubbed a hand over his face and shook himself as though to throw off fatigue.
"Aye. Well," he said, "you'll have seen they were brothers."
"I did notice that, yes. Where the hell did the other one come from?"
"From there."
He lifted his chin, pointing toward the west. Thanks to the washout, there was an unimpeded view of a small cove in the hollow below, one of those natural breaks in the wilderness where the trees gave way to meadow and stream. From the trees at the edge of the cove, a thin plume of smoke rose upward, pointing like a finger in the still, cold air. Squinting, I could make out what looked like a small farmhouse with a couple of rickety outbuildings. As I watched, a tiny figure emerged from the house and headed toward one of the sheds.
"They're just about to discover that he's gone," Jamie said, a trifle grimly. "Though with luck, they'll think he's only gone to the privy, or to milk the goats."
I didn't bother asking how he knew they had goats.
"Is that their home, Josiah and his brother?" "In a manner of speaking, Sassenach. They were bond servants."
"Were?" I said sceptically. Somehow I doubted that the brothers' terms of indenture had just happened to expire the night before. Jamie lifted one shoulder in a shrug and wiped a dripping nose on his sleeve.
"Unless someone catches them, aye."
"You caught Josiah," I pointed out. "What did he tell you?"
"The truth," he said, with a slight twist of the mouth. "Or at least, I think so."
He had hunted Josiah through the dark, guided by the sound of the boy's frantic wheezing, and trapped him at last in a rocky hollow, seizing him in the dark. He had wrapped the freezing boy in his plaid, sat him down, and with judicious application of patience and firmness, augmented with sips of whiskey from his flask, had succeeded at last in extracting the story.
"The family were immigrants, father, mother, and six bairns. Only the twins survived the passage. The rest perished of illness at sea. There were no relatives here, or none that met the boat at any rate, and so the ship's master sold them. The price wouldn't cover the cost of the family's passage, so the lads were indentured for 30 years, their wages to be put toward the debt."
His voice in the telling was matter-of-fact. These things happened. I knew they did, but was much less inclined to accept them without comment.
30 years? Why, that's... How old were they at the time?
2 or 3, he said.
I was taken aback at that.
Overlooking the basic tragedy,
that was some mitigation, I supposed. If the boy's purchaser had provided for their welfare as children. But I remembered Josiah's scrawny ribs and the bowing of his legs. They hadn't been all that well provided for. But then, neither were a good many children who came from loving homes.
Josiah's no idea who his parents were, where they came from, nor what their names were, Jamie explained.
He coughed briefly and cleared his throat.
He kent his own name and that of his brother. The brother's name is Keziah, but nothing else. Beardsley is the name of the man who took them, and as for the lads, they dinna ken if they're Scots, English, Irish. With names like that, they are likely aren't German or Polish. But even that's not impossible.
I puffed a cloud of thoughtful steam, temporarily obscuring the farmhouse below. So Josiah ran away. I imagine that had something to do with the brand on his thumb. Jamie nodded, eyes on the ground as his horse picked its way down the slope. The ground to either side of the gravel was soft, and clumps of black dirt showed like creeping fungus through the scree.
He stole a cheese. He was honest enough about that.
His mouth widened in momentary amusement.
Took it from a dairy shed in Brownsville. But the dairymaid saw him. In fact, the maid said 'twas the other, the brother who took it, but...
Jamie's ruddy brows drew together for a moment.
Perhaps Josiah wasn't so honest about it as I thought. At any rate, one of the boys took the cheese. Beardsley caught the two of them with it and summoned the sheriff, and Josiah took the blame and the punishment.
The boy had run away from the farm following this incident, which took place 2 years before. Josiah had, he told Jamie, always intended to return and rescue his brother so soon as he could contrive a place for them to live. Jamie's offer had seemed a godsend to him, and he had left the gathering to make his way back on foot.
Imagine his surprise to find us perched there on the hillside, Jamie said,
and sneezed. He wiped his nose, eyes watering slightly.
He was lurking close by, trying to make up his mind whether to wait until we'd gone or find out whether we were headed for the farm. Thinking, if so, we might make a fine distraction for him to slip in and steal away his brother.
So you decided to slip in with him instead and help with the stealing?
My own nose was dripping from the cold. I groped for my handkerchief with one hand, trusting to the horse, Mrs. Piggy, not to catapult us head over heels down the mountainside while I blew my nose. I eyed Jamie over the hanky. He still had the clammy, red-nosed look of illness, but his high cheekbones were flushed with the morning sun, and he looked remarkably cheerful for a man who'd been out in a cold wood all night. Fun, was it?
Oh, aye, it was. I've not done anything like that in years.
Jamie's eyes creased into blue triangles with his grin.
It reminded me of raiding into the Grant's land with Dougal and his men when I was a lad. Creeping through the dark, stealing into the barn without a sound. Christ, I had to stop myself in time before I took the cow. Or I would have, if they'd had one.
I sniffed and laughed indulgently.
You are the most complete bandit, Jamie, I said.
Bandit?
He said, mildly affronted.
I'm a very honest man, Sassenach. Or at least I am when I can afford to be,
he amended with a quick glance behind, to be sure we weren't overheard.
Oh, you're entirely honest, I assured him. Too honest for your own good, in fact. You're just not very law-abiding.
This observation appeared to disconcert him slightly, for he frowned and made a gruff sound in his throat that might have been either a Scottish noise of disagreement or merely an attempt to dislodge phlegm. He coughed, then reined in, and, standing up in his stirrups, waved his hat to Roger, who was some distance up the slope.
Roger waved back and turned his horse's nose in our direction. I pulled my horse in beside Jamie and dropped the reins on its neck.
"I'll have wee Roger take the men on to Brownsville," Jamie explained, sitting back in his saddle, "while I go and call upon the Beardsleys alone. Will you come with me, Sassenach, or go on with Roger?"
"Oh, I'll come with you," I said, without hesitation. "I want to see what these Beardsleys are like."
He smiled and brushed back his hair with one hand before replacing his hat. He wore his hair loose to cover his neck and ears against the cold, and it shone like molten copper in the morning sun.
"I thought you might. Mind your face, though," he said in half-mocking warning. "Dinna go gape-jawed or gooseberry, and they mention their missing serving lad."
"Mind your own face," I said, rather crossly. "Gooseberry, indeed."
Did Josiah say that he and his brother were badly treated? I wondered whether there had been more to Josiah's leaving than the cheese incident. Jamie shook his head.
"I didn't ask, and he didn't say. But ask yourself, Sassenach, would you leave a decent home to go and live in the woods alone, to make your bed in cold leaves and eat grubs and crickets till you learn to hunt meat?"
He nudged his horse into motion and rode up the slope to meet Roger, leaving me pondering that conjecture. He returned a few moments later, and I turned my mount in beside him, another question in my mind. But if things were bad enough here as to force him to leave, why didn't his brother go with him? Jamie glanced at me, surprised, but then smiled a little grimly.
"Keziah's deaf, Sassenach."
Not born deaf, from what Josiah had told him. His twin had lost his hearing as the result of an injury, occurring at the age of 5 or so. Keziah could therefore speak, but not hear any but the loudest of noises, and, unable to perceive the sound of rustling leaves or shuffling feet, could neither hunt nor avoid pursuit.
"He says Keziah understands him, and doubtless he does. When we crept into the barn, I kept watch below while the lad went up the ladder to the loft. I didn't hear a sound, but within a minute both lads were down on the floor beside me, Keziah rubbing the sleep from his eyes. I hadna realised they were twins. Gave me a turn to see the two of them so like."
"I wonder why Keziah didn't bring away his breeches," I said, touching on one thing that had been puzzling me.
Jamie laughed.
"I asked. Seems he'd taken them off the night before, left them in the hay, and one of the barn cats had kittens on them. He didn't want to disturb her."
I laughed too, though with an uneasy memory of pale, bare feet, blue-tinged skin showing purple in the firelight.
"Kind lad. And his shoes?"
"He hadn't any."
By now we had reached the bottom of the slope. The horses milled for a moment, turning in a slow gyre round Jamie as directions were decided, rendezvous appointed, farewells taken. Then Roger, with only slight evidence of self-consciousness, whistled through his teeth and waved his hat in the air in summons. I watched him ride away and noticed him half turn in the saddle, then turn back, looking straight ahead.
"He's no sure they'll really follow him," Jamie said, watching.
He shook his head critically, then shrugged, dismissing it.
"I will. He'll manage or not."
"He'll manage," I said, thinking of the night before.
"I'm glad you think so, Sassenach. Come on, then."
He clicked his tongue and reined his horse's head around. "If you're not sure Roger can manage, why are you sending him on his own?" I inquired of his back, swaying in the saddle as we turned into the thin copse that lay between us and the now invisible farm. "Why not keep the men together and take them into Brownsville yourself?"
"For one thing, he'll no learn, and I didn't give him the chance. For another..."
He paused, turning to look back at me.
"For another, I didna want the whole boiling coming along to the Beardsleys and maybe hearing of their missing servant. The whole camp saw Josiah last night, aye? If you've a lad missing,
and hear of a lad popping up and causing a stir in the forest nearby, conclusions might be drawn, do you not think?
He turned back, and I followed him through a narrow defile between the pine trees. Dew gleamed like diamonds on bark and needle, and small icy drops fell from the boughs above, startling my skin where they fell.
"Unless this Beardsley is old or infirm, though, won't he be joining you?" I objected. "Someone's bound to mention Josiah in his hearing sooner or later."
He shook his head, not turning round.
"And tell him what, if they do? They saw the lad when we dragged him in, and they saw him run away again. For all they can, he got clear away."
"Kenny Lindsay saw them both when you brought them back?" He shrugged.
"Aye. I had a word with Kenny when we were saddling the horses. He'll say nothing."
He was right, I knew. Kenny was one of his Ardsmuir men. He would follow Jamie's orders without question.
"No," Jamie went on, skilfully reining round a large boulder. "Beardsley's not infirm. Josiah told me he's an Indian trader, taking goods across the treaty line to the Cherokee villages. What I don't know is if he's to home just now. If he is, though..."
He drew breath and paused to cough as the cold air tickled his lungs.
"That's the other reason for sending the men ahead," he continued, wheezing slightly. "We'll not join them again until tomorrow, I think. By that time, they'll have had a night to drink and be sociable in Brownsville. They'll scarce recall the lad, and be the less likely to speak of him in Beardsley's hearing. With luck, we'll be well away before anything's said. No chance of Beardsley's leaving us to pursue the lad, then."
So he was counting on the Beardsleys being sufficiently hospitable as to put us up for the night. A reasonable expectation in this neck of the woods. Listening to him cough again, I resolved to sit on his chest this evening, if necessary, and oblige him to be well greased with camphor, whether he liked it or not. We emerged from the trees, and I glanced dubiously at the farmhouse ahead. It was smaller than I had thought, and rather shabby, with a cracked step, a sagging porch, and a wide patch of shingles missing from the weathered roof. Well, I'd slept in worse places, and likely would again. The door to a stunted barn gaped open, but there was no sign of life. The whole place seemed deserted, save for the plume of smoke from the chimney. I had meant what I'd said to Jamie, though I hadn't been entirely accurate. He was honest, and also law-abiding, provided that the laws were those he chose to respect. The mere fact that a law had been established by the Crown was not, I knew, sufficient to make it law in his eyes. Other laws, unwritten, he would likely die for. Still, while the law of property meant somewhat less to an erstwhile Highland raider than it might to others, it hadn't escaped my attention, and therefore certainly hadn't escaped his, that he was about to claim both hospitality and duty from a man whose property he had just helped to abscond. Jamie had no deep-seated objection to indenture as such, I knew. Ordinarily, he would respect such a claim. Though he hadn't meant that he perceived some higher law in operation, though whether that was friendship, pity, the claim of his fealty, or something else, I didn't know. He had paused, waiting for me. "Why did you decide to help Josiah?" I asked bluntly as we made our way across the ragged cornfield that lay before the house. Dry stalks snapped beneath the horse's feet, and ice crystals glittered on the litter of dead leaves. Jamie took off his hat and set it on the saddle before him as he tied back his hair in preparation for meeting company.
"Well, I said to him that if he was set on this course, so be it. But if he chose to come to the ridge, alone or with his brother, then we must rid him of the mark on his thumb, for it would cause talk, and word might get back to yon Beardsley, with the devil to pay and all that."
He took a deep breath and let it out, the smoke of it wisping white around his head, then turned to look at me, his face serious.
The lad didn't hesitate for a moment, though he'd been branded. He knew. And I'll tell you, Sassenach, while a man may do a desperate thing once from love or courage, it takes something more than that.